Hello and welcome to the Maine Reader on Maine Airs, a service of the IRIS Network. My name is Randy Labar. I am reading Finding Amy, a True Story of Murder in Maine by Captain Joseph K. Laughlin and Kate Clark Flora, published by University Press of New England, Lebanon, New Hampshire. Copyright 2006 by Joseph K. Laughlin and Kate Clark Flora. In our last episode, the extensive search for Amy St. Laurent continued, while the background investigation on Russ Gorman also continued. We proceed with Episode 9 of Finding Amy on page 91. Following the trail of potential witnesses was like working in a gigantic maze and consumed hundreds of hours. Detective Mark Tesseno and evidence technician Chris Stearns conducted many of the follow-up interviews with young women who had known Gorman through the Old Port bar scene. Often, one witness would lead them to another, and to another, and another. Each casually dropped name, or, "Oh, you should talk with so-and-so, she used to hang out with Russ," or, "I've heard that this girl knows something she isn't telling," or, "Russ said something to so-and-so, but she's afraid to talk to the police," or, "So-and-so knows more than she's telling, but don't let her know that I told you," led to a name on the dry board, a phone call, and often an interview. Over and over, detectives would say, "Tell me about Russ. How do you know him? Have you ever seen or experienced Gorman being violent toward women? Have you heard anything about Gorman supplying drugs or using drugs to obtain sex? If Gorman were going to take a girl somewhere for sex, where would he go? Where did he take you? Have you or anyone you know ever seen Gorman with a gun? Has he ever mentioned Amy St. Laurent or spoken about what happened that night?" As the days ticked by without a body or a break, Lieutenant Laughlin decided to consult a psychic. He had heard Vicki Monroe on the radio and read a very convincing article about her in the newspaper. "I call Vicki Monroe, a popular local psychic who has turned many non-believers into believers. What the hell? It can't hurt. We're at the point where we'll check anything, everything. I explain who I am, and she has heard of the case. I say, 'Tell me where Amy is, Vicki.' Vicki tells me that something happened in a car with Amy. This is what we believe, and at this point, there's nothing in the press. She gives me the first name, Jeff or Jay. Amy is telling her that she is underneath something but cannot say where. It is near water. There were other guys around and in the car, but Jay is responsible. She tells me that the suspect has an enraged personality and a criminal record, which I suppose is pretty obvious. She also thinks that Amy was given drugs, and she would not normally go with a stranger. This we also believe was true, as does Amy's mother, Diane. Vicki tells me that Amy is definitely deceased, and keeps saying it was violent, and that she is under something. Vicki tells me that we're looking in the wrong direction, and we should look north. Vicki wants to talk to Diane as well. We receive a lot of calls from psychics, and although we never discuss or reveal anything in an investigation, some of their thoughts may trigger events or thoughts in us. Dan told me he had had calls from another woman named Marie Roberts of Westbrook. Marie drew a map of where she believed Amy was, but could not say exactly where the body was. These individuals are passionate about what they do and sincerely believe in their abilities. I do not dismiss the possibilities of another developed sense or sixth sense. I agreed to meet one psychic near my home on a sunny November Saturday. This woman had had a vivid dream of Amy calling to her from her burial spot. It frightened this woman, the hideous image that she saw of Amy buried in the sand around a river in Yarmouth. She was very convincing. We often worked through weekends anyhow, so we met and drove off to the woods of Yarmouth. We walked through fields, woods, down to the river for several hours. One vivid memory I have is of this woman hugging a tree and telling me she feels Amy's presence and message, but Amy cannot place exactly where she is. A few feet away, I'm wrapped around another tree, pleading with the spirit world and this woman. Okay, okay, just tell me where she is. Just tell us where you are, Amy. Silently praying to God. On the way back to Portland, empty-handed, I heard Danny Young over the police radio calling for a patrol car to meet with an officer. Danny just couldn't stop. Chapter 9. Because criminals are devious, the police are constantly creating their own, equally resourceful and legal, strategies for tripping criminals up. Sergeant Joyce put it this way: a good investigator needs to know where the line is, legally, and then walk right up to that line. The detectives working on the St. Lawrence case would think of many ways to get Gorman to lead them to Amy's body. At one point in mid-November, they sat down in their war room to put together a complicated joint surveillance operation. Their plan was to attach a tracking device, a bird dog, to Gorman's car, then let him know that a body had been discovered, hoping that he would be spooked into checking his hiding place and lead them to the body. Attaching such a device would be legal so long as the car was parked in a public place. Like any well-planned operation, their plan had several alternatives depending on Gorman's whereabouts. As part of the operation, they had recruited two attractive female state troopers, Detective Angela Blodgett and Trooper Corey Pike. Dressed in plain clothes, the two women were going to stop at pizza time while Gorman was at work, order a pizza, and while they waited, discuss the news that a body had been found so they could observe Gorman's reaction. Scott Heracles' job was to guard the rear door in case Gorman came out while Lance McLeish was putting the bird dog on Gorman's car, which was usually parked behind the building. If Gorman got through the door, they joked, he might just have to get mugged. I was really looking forward to that, Heracles said. After all their planning, on the day of the operation, with all the vehicles in place to follow him, Gorman didn't show up for work. He had quit his job. By that time, the police had many cars rolling, including a unit by Gorman's mother's house and one by the game room. Eventually, word came in that Gorman's car was parked at the game room, and Plan B began. Blodgett and Pike went into the game room and hung around, hoping to meet up with Gorman, while other detectives rolled into the lot to put the device on Gorman's car. Sergeant Bruce Coffin described the event. It was a crazy night. We were doing everything we could think of to find Amy. Our challenge was to find Gorman's car in a public place and then attach the device securely in a place that wouldn't interfere with the signal. We waited until his car was parked at a pool hall in Westbrook, the game room. I was in one car with Sergeant Matt Stewart, and there were two other troopers, Scott Heracles and Lance McLeish, in a second car. We all pulled into the lot, putting our cars between Gorman's car and the group of guys standing outside the pool hall smoking, so they couldn't see what we were doing. Then we all got out and stood around, making like a bunch of good old boys who'd been drinking, lots of noise and handshaking, backslapping, while McLeish crept out of the car, crawled under Gorman's car, and installed the device. It was a very tense scene. Once the device was in place, they all got back into their cars and drove away, waiting at designated places for word that Gorman had returned to his car and was rolling. Nothing seemed to go as planned. Although his car was in the lot, Gorman never did go to the game room that night, so they were unable to drop the rumor about the body. Eventually, he returned to his car and drove to his mother's house. With as many as six cars parked at strategic places up and down the street, the detectives revised the plan to get word to him by having a friend call Gorman at home and tell him that a body had been found. Later that evening, as they did surveillance on Gorman's house, Matt Despins called Gorman to say he'd heard that a body had been found. Sergeant Coffin was outside in the cold, walking up and down the road, keeping an eye on the place, waiting for Gorman's car to leave. Everyone had expected movement, but Gorman didn't budge. Finally, late into the night, they called the operation off. Police also worked closely with several of Gorman's friends, hoping that, in an unguarded or intoxicated moment, Gorman would confide something incriminating. On his side, Gorman, who was an experienced criminal, was engaging in disinformation to test his supposed friends. He would tell them stories that weren't true to see if those stories got back to the police. At one point, for example, he told a friend, "If I had killed that girl, I would have dropped her off at the B&M trestle and let the crabs get her." Police had to assume that this might be the truth, and so they searched the area. Early in the investigation, the Maine State Police had done some aerial searches. Now Lieutenant Laughlin and MSP Detective Lance McLeish conducted another set of aerial searches arranged by Diane Jenkins' employer, DeWolf Realty, with a helicopter and pilot donated by Sam Hamill of TCI Aircraft. They were hoping that with the leaves off the trees, they might have a better chance of spotting something. 11:21:01. "The rotors are still thwapping and the fast air washes across my face. Out pops this small man with dark hair and bright eyes. After introductions, he starts blurting out questions and orders. 'Did you guys do this and that? How come you haven't arrested him?' 'Whoa, Airwolf,' I say to myself, but entertain his questions because this man is willing to help. All the while, I want to scream, 'What? Are you friggin' kidding me? Do I tell you how to fly the chopper?' We are all so exhausted and frustrated at this point. I've just been introduced to Mr. Sam Hamill, a.k.a. Airwolf. I'm so backed up at work, I don't have time for this. Plus, we've already done aerial searches, but these people want to do something to help. I tell myself, 'Okay, let's just try to enjoy the ride, and who knows, it's another chance to find Amy.' We're in a beautiful, sleek, black Bell helicopter. It's Lance McLeish from the State Police, Dave Gulick from DeWolf Realty, who's a friend of Diane's, me, the pilot, whose name is John, and Sam. Over the intercom, Sam barks orders to John, and we lift off. What a great view of Portland. Only, we're not up here for the view. We travel south over the interstate, chugging and chattering, about 200 feet up, studying the woods, roads border. I keep hoping we'll see something, anything, all the way down to Berwick. Nothing. We head back northbound over the pine trees. Amazing the amount of ground you can see. We stare till our eyes hurt, but there's nothing. Over the noise of the flight, the headset clicks as Sam continues his line of questioning about what we did or didn't do. I'm exhausted. I've walked through the woods, over bridges, down tracks, along the water almost every weekend and some nights after work. When I jogged Riverside Industrial Parkway near my home, I would check behind the buildings for Amy. If this is how I am, how does Danny function? I ask Amy, show us, please show us. I have a list of areas we want to check, and I relay that to Sam and the pilot. I still think, from the things that Gorman said, that she's in the water, and we head toward the Four River. The vibrations chugging with a downdraft every now and then help keep me alert. We fly over a wooded area called the Hobo Jungle, across to the Merrill Transport, looking, searching. It's low tide and the water is clear. It's amazing how far down we can see. Every now and then something looks odd, but turns out to be nothing, or debris. Airwolf's chatter breaks my concentration. Yes, sir, we have investigated that point. Yeah, we have a suspect, but no Amy. Why don't you bring this guy in and beat the crap out of him? You can't? Let me talk to him. Well, Sam, I respond, we have a constitution, you know, that protects people from that. It's not like on TV, you know. Well, can't you guys just tell me who he is? I chuckle, but I'm exasperated and tired. There are so many goddamn quarterbacks, and I can't go 5 feet without running into one. I know Sam cares and means well, but he hasn't been doing this every day for a month. I bring my mind back into the search. Amy, where are you? We bank left, and the centrifugal force pulls on my belt. A Coast Guard boat below in Casco Bay is also searching for Amy. Go over to the B&M factory and fly over the tracks. Of course, Airwolf's first question is an excited, why? What's going on over there? Well, Sam, it's something in the investigation I can't discuss right now, and I just want to see it by air. What do you mean? Look, I say frustrated. Can we just look? He says to the pilot, a staccato, Whiskey, Bravo, Tom, 179er, changing vector to... And we change course. The noise fades into the background. I'm thinking about what Gorman said to a friend about how, if he'd killed her, he would have dumped Amy off at the B&M trestle, and my anger burns. Imagine. Imagine. Now I know this guy killed her and did something with Amy, but where? And I imagine killing someone, and then making a statement like that. I think of all the victims I've seen over 22 years and the assholes who do despicable things and walk away. The arrogance. The GP, general public, has absolutely no idea of the horrors that occur each day, that occur right here in Portland. At one point, we're near Gorman's mother's house and she comes out and stares up at us. She doesn't wave. As we move off, Sam shouts, "Guilty, guilty, guilty! People always wave. I've never seen that." Chugging slow with a thwop over the terminal and factory, I can see down into the water. Last weekend I spent hours walking over the trestle and peering down into the cold azure water, hoping to see something, begging Amy to show me. She was on my mind all the time. But God, what was it like for Danny? I know he's at another interview while I'm flying. Danny has his own daughter, Amy. Yet, when we say Amy, he thinks about Amy St. Laurent. My mind drifts as we thwop along. Danny walked by my office last night around 1900, and no doubt he was ill. Pasty, pale, sweaty, and heading toward the bathroom. Danny, go home. You're not going to be any good, sick. He looks at me directly and says, "I can't, Lieutenant. I can't." I know he's right, but I say, "Try to get some rest, Dan. Try." We hear him in the bathroom, throwing up, running a fever and sick as a dog. He looks like hell, but he won't go home. Whiskey Bravo, Tom, 179er, changing course to... I'm back to Airwolf, and we're winding down. We fly Back Bay, which is crystal clear. It's almost tropical in the warmth of the chopper, and head back to the terminal. All the while, the wolf chatters. What about this? What about that? How come? Lance and I catch a glimpse, and we know. Out of the wash on the helipad, we shake hands with the wolf. I am grateful for the man's generosity. He's a good man, if quirky. I get into my car, dreading what awaits me when I return to the office. My message bank will be maxed. My emails maxed. People will be waiting. On the way in, I'm stopped by Penny Diaz, my assistant, who must work diligently through all the chaos and personalities, and who does a great job. But right now, Penny's not feeling patient. "Call this person now," she says, "and I'm really sick of Tommy. You have to do something." "Penny, not now. Who called?" I'm handed a stack of pink messages, and I see Tommy is waiting for me about some news. "Give me a minute, Tommy, just a minute." I see Detective Rick Swift, wide-eyed, trying to catch my eye through the sea of detectives. The Swift one, as we call him, is not aggressive, but I know he wants to talk to me now. "Lieutenant, you wouldn't believe what happened on the Coast Guard boat today." I sweep him into my office and let him talk. What happened was that they spotted a girl, fully dressed and in a heavy coat, 100 yards out in the cold November ocean, trying to commit suicide in the 48-degree water. As the boat approached, she turned and headed back toward shore, where officers and MedQ personnel that they had called were waiting and took her to the main medical center. If they hadn't been out looking for Amy, they never would have seen her, and she wouldn't have been saved. Many believe that Amy had led them to this girl. To increase the pressure on Gorman, police decided to go public with a detail that had previously been kept under wraps, the fact that their investigation showed that Gorman never dropped Amy off at the pavilion. Gorman had told police that there were people milling around in front of the pavilion when he dropped her off, around 1:45 a.m., yet it was well known that at that hour there were not many people around. The few people on the street would have noticed Amy St. Laurent. The investigation that disproved Gorman's lie had been vast, Everyone the detectives had spoken with, from every walk of life, bums, bouncers, bystanders, bartenders, customers returning to the pavilion on other nights, and police professionals in the area, confirmed that neither Gorman nor Amy nor Gorman's car had been seen at the time he claimed to have dropped her off. "Yeah, I agree, Tom, Dan. It's time to turn up the burners on this. I explained the plan to Chief Chitwood, and he agrees with our strategy. Tuesday, November 27th, 2001. We decide to go public with the fact that Amy was never dropped off at the Pavilion Nightclub. We won't mention Gorman, but he and his friends will know what we mean. I contact David Hench of the Portland Press-Herald. Of all the media personnel I work with, I have established the most trust with him. The next day, it's front page news, with Amy's lovely photo smiling at us again. I'm quoted as saying, "We've substantiated Amy was last seen leaving a Brighton Avenue address with a male. There is no evidence to suggest she was dropped off. After extensive interviews and research, we have not been able to isolate that as a fact." The article reports that we have shifted our focus somewhat. I never identify Russ Gorman as the male, but it's out. When the media ask about the male, I respond, "He's one of many people we're looking at." So now it's out, and we're hoping that Gorman will start a tailspin. We shall see. Suspicion about Gorman's involvement had been growing over the weeks since Amy disappeared. Increasingly, when he went out in the Old Port, he found himself not the center of an admiring and friendly crowd, but the object of questions and hostile behavior. When newspaper articles suggested that this male was the primary focus of the investigation, the revelation confirmed in the minds of many of Gorman's friends and acquaintances what they had suspected. At one point, he was assaulted in the Old Port by members of a gang called FSU, who demanded to know, "What did you do to that girl?" Getting beaten up really shook him. Friends reported that he was drinking heavily and using more drugs. He was jittery, aggressive, and unstable, his conversation frequently rambling and incoherent. As life in the Portland area grew more uncomfortable for Gorman, the detectives learned that he was planning to leave the state. Where he was going was uncertain. He mentioned Alabama and Florida, where he still had friends and relatives, but also California and Mexico. He'd talked of making some quick money growing mushrooms and selling club drugs. Gorman planned to travel south with a friend named Sean Littlefield, using Littlefield's car. The detectives believed that if he got away from Portland to a place where he felt more comfortable, he was likely to let down his guard and confide in someone about his crime. They expected that Gorman would stay in touch with his mother, and that Littlefield would be in touch with friends and family in Maine, so they probably wouldn't lose sight of Gorman. And because he was on probation and required to report regularly to his probation officer, he needed probation's permission to leave the state. Leaving without permission would be a probation violation and make him subject to arrest. Therefore, they could always arrest him and return him to Maine. Still, they were considering letting their prime suspect, a dangerous man, and one they believed had committed a murder, out of their sight. It was not an idea they were comfortable with. "Well, crap, Tom, you know the consequences as well as I do. What if this freak hurts someone? It will be me asked in some federal lawsuit who was in charge of day-to-day ops. Can you hear it?" "Yes, Lieutenant, I hear it, but it's worth the risk. He's nervous, hot, and he knows it. He will talk. We both know that. We gotta let the line out." "Tom, will you just sit for a minute and stop pacing? You're making me dizzy." "Joe, he's already saying stuff. You know he'll open up to relatives down in Alabama and to this kid, Sean." "Yeah, yeah. What about Matt Stewart?" "He's worried. It's risky." I look at the wall, at a painting of Back Bay, and think for a moment. Tommy doesn't stop talking. "Do you want this guy?" I look at Tom's piercing blue eyes, glaring under his unruly dark hair. We lock eyes. "Okay," I sigh. "Let the line out, Tom. Let him go. Keep it tight till I tell the chief the plan in the AM. Like a kid who's gotten his way, Tommy flies out of my room, the door vibrating off the wall. The detectives knew that if they did let Gorman run, they could always bring him back on a probation violation. But arresting him for a probation violation would only put him in jail temporarily, and when he got out, it might trigger him to run away further. What they all wanted was for Gorman to be in jail on a murder charge, but they needed more than they had so far. Before he left, Gorman had a conversation with a friend named Brent Plummer that Plummer recorded, using the message function on his cell phone and laying it casually on the table as they talked. Gorman, I don't want to leave on bad terms, but I do want you to know, and I want everyone to know, no matter what the outcome is, I've got letters typed up at my house, at Mom's house, but I can't go back there right now. Plummer, you got letters typed? To who? What kind of letters? Gorman, explaining everything. Plummer, why everything? Gorman, well, why I'm leaving, I'm also saying that you, all you people know, dude, all you friggin' people that I know, my parents, everyone, know that I love my little girl, and I couldn't possibly imagine my little girl 25 years old and disappearing or not knowing what happened to her, so that right there should just show something. Dude, I do have mental problems, I do, but I'm not that kind of person, dude. Shortly before Thanksgiving, Gorman and Sean Littlefield left Maine in Littlefield's small red Neon and drove to Troy, Alabama. Well, that's all we have time for on this edition of The Maine Reader. We're reading Finding Amy, A True Story of Murder in Maine by Captain Joseph K. Laughlin and Kate Clark Flora. This is The Maine Reader on Maine Airs. My name is Randy LaBarre. Thank you for listening.